Hello. Later on today, advice for visually impaired listeners concerned about being asked to verify their age on websites. But first, some stories just won't lie down. Ever since the spring, we've been receiving a steady stream of emails from people deeply worried about developments at the Macular Society. For almost 40 years, the Society has provided support for thousands of people with aspects of the condition, which is the greatest cause of sight loss among adults in the UK, particularly prevalent as people get older. The concern is over the decision to cut the numbers of regional managers responsible for organising support groups for those with the condition and taking it under control back at head office. This would involve a number of redundancies, but the emails have come largely from volunteers who help with the work and those with macular disease themselves. Listeners have argued that the manager's work has been invaluable over the years and that crucial face-to-face support would be lost. We pressed for several weeks for the Society to appear on the programme, but were repeatedly told that it wouldn't be possible while internal consultations on the reorganisation plans were taking place. Meanwhile, it became clear that there was considerable tension within the organisation, and some people had been summarily dismissed for what was described as gross misconduct. Then, in mid-August, CEO Ed Holloway did come onto the programme to address some of the points listeners had raised. Here's part of what he told us at the time.
Change is difficult, and change of this nature within organisations can often be a challenging process. The consultation process is ongoing. We're listening to feedback and we'll be making final decisions in the coming weeks and months.
So what is the plan? What's the overall plan and how does it differ from what you were doing before?
So in terms of the regional team, as I say, the final decisions haven't been made, but currently that team's got about 24 people in, and under our proposals, it would reduce to 14. So it's still the largest team within the organisation, and we're confident that that's enough resource to provide really high quality support to our volunteers. Whereas at the moment it is an entirely regional team, that would involve more central support. And what that means is we can create some new roles, for example, focused on volunteer communication or learning and development or recruiting volunteers. So we think that that team can work more effectively and continue to enable our local groups to thrive.
But far from calming things down, this just seems to have added fuel to the fire. There's currently a multi-part podcast circulating, which purports to tell the story from beginning to end. We've chosen not to rely on this because we felt that we had reliable sources of our own. It also appears only to tell one side of the story. In any case, we don't need to rely on it because listeners have continued to contact us in large numbers. And I've also been talking directly to a number of those within the organisation, including some of those who've lost their jobs, one of whom you'll hear in a moment. But first, these are reactions from listeners, read by our colleagues.
All the points raised were met with the same platitudes we've been hearing since the changes were announced 4 months ago, and we're no further forward in discovering the real reasoning behind the proposed changes, nor how it's going to work in the future. The CEO continues to assure members of the Society's support for those living with macular conditions and yet appears unaware or even concerned that services are breaking down. The general feeling of abandonment is palpable.
I am a volunteer with the Macular Society and have been for 11 years. I run a successful peer support group in our local town. The regional manager has been an enormous support to us in setting up the group originally. The reorganisation of the society as planned will decimate the regional manager support for the peer groups. Groups will fail and the donations for the society will be reduced. I am far from alone in my anxieties about Mr. Holloway's vision for the society and feel that In Touch needs to highlight the way he's ripping apart all the great work which has been done in the past.
Why has the Macular Society pressed the self-destruct button? I became a member after I was diagnosed with a genetic eye condition at the suggestion of my ophthalmologists, as it was apparent there was no support from the NHS available. The group has been very successful, and we have been able to support many, many other people with eye conditions. This has only been made possible by the invaluable support of our regional manager, with her lifelong experience and willingness to run the meetings when we are not available. Without her help, we will not be able to run the group on our own. And it was with great sadness that at our last meeting, we had to break the news to our members that we would be closing the group at Christmas. I feel sickened by the whole mess and feel very sorry for the people the society was set up to help and has now abandoned.
Messages from John Ward, and before that you heard from Jean Ellis and Tricia Sturgeon. There were many more. Sue Drew is one of those who was sacked for gross misconduct. She's been telling me about the events of the past few months from her point of view.
I am a regional manager and I cover central East England, which is six counties.
Just explain how you heard that your role was at risk.
So my team, we were in a planning meeting for what we were going to achieve this year. We came out of that meeting and we all had an email from Ed Holloway, the CEO, and that was the 31st of March, saying that basically that unfortunately some jobs would be at risk due to a restructure. And then I think it was 5 days before there was a meeting with us to discuss it.
What was your reaction to this?
I mean, shock. I think we all felt there was change needed in the charity, but we didn't all think it would be entirely on our team because, you know, without saying that we're wonderful, we are the people on the ground. We're the ones out there that have the contact, face-to-face contact with people, hospitals, ECHOs, all of those networking relationships.
So it's understandable that you would be upset to discover that your job was at risk, but a new CEO is surely entitled to look at all the circumstances at the organisation he's just taken over and make the changes that he feels are necessary. Nobody likes change, you know, particularly if things have gone on like this for a long time and people are comfortable. Is there an element of that in what's happened?
I don't think so, because we were hoping the change would be good. We hadn't had, in my opinion, much guidance and support, didn't feel very valued. And we know, and our members know, the important job we were doing. So yes, obviously our livelihoods were at risk. I mean, that's a normal reaction. But we wanted to make that change as easy for our members and volunteers and beneficiaries as possible. It was hard to know how all of this, without a plan that we understood or could see, was beneficial to those people.
Sue, initially, as we've said, you were told your job was at risk. How did this develop into your being sacked?
So on the 23rd of April, when we really weren't getting anywhere and we were frustrated and we were aware that another colleague had left and the circumstances of that, we were really, really unnerved and felt that all trust and confidence had gone for us. So there was an email from one of my colleagues saying, I'd like to discuss something with you. I'm going to create a WhatsApp group so that we can, you know, speak privately. And that was done with all our personal numbers on our own devices, nothing to do with work. On the 15th of May, we became aware that someone had access to that. In that group, I'd be quite honest, 90% of that was talking about how did we do a counter proposal? How could we get the information? Did we need to put a grievance in because it had gone, you know, it was just, in our opinion, speaking for myself, certainly a sham consultation. We work remotely. I think that has to be said. We work across the whole of the UK and we never see each other really, maybe once a year, if we're lucky, apart from Teams meetings. So we couldn't go down the pub. We couldn't go around someone's house. We couldn't speak. But this was a private group on our own devices. So there were some, I can't think of the word to use.
Well, can I help you? Would you deny that some of the language used was quite aggressive, even offensive?
I would say yes, that you could say that from the other perspective. You know, we've all acknowledged that. We've all had disciplinaries. We've all spoken up for ourselves. That, If you'd said that in private, just in a conversation, it'd be said and gone and you wouldn't even remember it. And I'm not trying to justify things we said at all. Well, speak for myself, obviously, anything I've said. But it was frustration. We were venting and we were in private.
So was your dismissal based on something that you said on the WhatsApp group?
Yes, my dismissal was based, I can tell you precisely, on bullying harassment of the CEO. So, yes, but they were never. And one of the things I've really taken a stance on is we ask them constantly to look at the context, and they more than once said they were only interested in the content.
One final question. Why don't you accept that support offered centrally couldn't be as effective as what has happened in the past?
Because there will be no face-to-face. There will be, my understanding, is really digital, lots of offline contact. And I don't think you can reach people by a phone call, sending them a leaflet, as much as they can have in a peer support environment. We always say, and if you spoke to some of our members, I'm sure they'd agree, that that's the bit. So we can go to the hospital, we can have the medical stuff, it's all important. And we, even as regional managers, or some of us do live with sight loss, but as regional managers, we're not living their journey. We don't have that necessarily have that lived experience, but they all do. And what they get from each other is stronger, I believe, than anything they get. And I'm not denigrating leaflets, literature and everything else. The Macular Society has the most amazing helpline counselling service, which is a rare thing, a counselling service these days. It's amazing. But people have to get to it. They have to find it. Very often that comes through us and the groups and the face-to-face contact.
Sue Drew, thank you very much indeed. Well, once again, we invited CEO Ed Holloway onto the programme, but were told that consultations had restarted and that he's not able to give us an interview yet. Instead, he offered this statement. It's been voiced by one of our colleagues.
These matters are part of ongoing HR processes that need to be managed confidentially, so it would not be appropriate for us to comment on them at this time. We know this has been extremely difficult for everyone involved and that change can be unsettling for staff, volunteers and supporters. These changes are necessary to ensure we can continue our important work in the coming years. Throughout this time, the Society has followed procedures in line with ACAS guidance, employment rules and our own internal policies. We're unable to comment on individual cases, but it is important to note that the complaints related to serious issues of bullying, including in some cases the harassment of a disabled person. The employees involved have a right to appeal the decisions made, and any claims or comments should be addressed throughout that process. As an organisation, we remain focused on making sure the Society can continue to support everyone affected by macular disease. The consultation about changes is ongoing and should be concluded in the coming weeks when we will share more information publicly.
I said at the beginning of this report that this was a story that wouldn't lie down. Well, we're still receiving conflicting information from a range of informants, and it seems inevitable we'll return to this before long. Meanwhile, we've also recently been hearing about the problems created for visually impaired listeners by parts of the Online Safety Act. Now, that is aimed at ensuring that potentially harmful material can't be accessed by children and young people. But listeners have been telling us how the methods used for age verification under the Online Safety Act are very difficult for them to use and effectively excludes them from platforms they should have a perfect right to use. IT and data lawyer Matt Johnson was the person who first drew this to our attention.
I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in social issues, and I go on Reddit a lot, Discord as well. And a lot of this stuff was suddenly gated. They said, you know, you can't access this, you have to verify your age. The main ways that they say to do that is take a picture of your ID or put a camera to your face, and we'll do facial recognition tech to estimate your age. Both of these are quite obviously problematic from a visual impairment perspective. Not all of us are great at camera photos and positioning, and etc. And if you don't manage it, if you don't get the lineup absolutely correct, they will just kick it out.
Well, we've since heard from Ian Corby. Ian is Executive Director of the Age Verification Providers Association, which does what it says on the tin, offering to provide some advice about how such difficulties would be dealt with. He's currently travelling in New Zealand, but we're delighted to say that he took the time to join us from there. First of all, Ian, what do you make of the points that Matt makes?
So first of all, there's a problem, which is that I think a lot of sites, and you know, Reddit's a good example, are overinterpreting the law here. It shouldn't be preventing anybody, particularly adults, from accessing legal content. So I think we're going to have to work with Ofcom to put some pressure onto some of the platforms who aren't giving enough choice. But if you have choice, then some of the methods are actually pretty straightforward to use if you're competent on, you know, the internet day to day. So we can use, for example, just your mobile phone number or your email address, because you'll probably have used that in the past for what you might think of as adult-like activities. So taking out a mortgage or checking interest rates. And with enough sort of data points that say you've done that in the past, then we're allowed to infer that you're an adult with a high enough degree of confidence that Ofcom will accept that.
Also, Matt said that he had trouble, and he's very tech savvy, I can tell you, he had trouble uploading his passport.
Yeah, so this is why I think we need to move as quickly as possible to reusable and interoperable identities. So you can download a separate app on your phone, which is a digital identity, from which you can just share your age. And there's a number of them available, Yoti, Lucidity, and they will allow you to just prove your age very simply without having to, you know, go through that process again and again. You might need some help the first time you do it. So what we need to do is find a way that allows you to reuse the same check across every website or app you want to go to. We've actually built that. It wasn't quite ready for the go live in July when all these new rules came in. But you will see over the next 6 months, the whole industry cooperating to create this interoperability through a non-profit company we've set up. And I think we're at the peak pain point, and going forward, it should get a lot easier. One other point I did just want to make is if you don't have the actual ID that you need to start the process, we do have a sort of age verification of last resort, as it were, and that's through professional vouching. So somebody who is a doctor or a teacher or somebody else of standing in the community can just vouch for your age, and you'll get given a plastic card that you can then use for creating a digital proof of age. That's done through the PASS scheme, the proof of age standard scheme, which is operated sort of at arm's length, but is effectively a government body, and they set the standards for that.
Right. Well, that is all very helpful. I'm sure there are other things, but there's only so much we can fit in. I think we should say Ofcom have told us that if you do wish to complain about the accessibility of an age verification service, you should first report it to the provider in question. But you can also report it to the regulator by calling their customer contact centre. And I'll give you that number, 0300 123 33333. Lots of threes. Ian Corby, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Peter.
That's it for today. As usual, let's have your questions and comments. You've heard in today's programme just how much we value them for shining a light on a whole range of subjects. Email in touch at bbc.co.uk, or you can